Welcome to the Rainmaker Fundraising Podcast, where you'll get actionable tips and advice on major gifts, direct response fundraising, legacy giving, and much more from leading experts in the nonprofit sector. Now, here are your hosts of the Rainmaker Fundraising Podcast, Andrew Olson and Roy Jones.
Hey, this is Andrew Olson, host of the Rainmaker Fundraising Podcast, and we're coming to you today from beautiful Palm Springs, California at the CityGate Network Conference. I'm super excited. So I have two good friends here. My podcast co-host for the week, Sean Saunders, who's Vice President of Client Services at Dickerson Baker & Associate. Sean, welcome back.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
Glad to have you. Really enjoying the podcast that we've been recording this week. And our special guest for this afternoon is Richard Newcomb, the Vice President of Philanthropy and Social Enterprise at Union Rescue Mission in Los Angeles. Richard, welcome today.
Great. Glad to be here. Thank you so much.
Thank you for making time for us, and thanks for your willingness to share with us. Before we jump in, I'd love for you to take a few minutes, tell us a little bit about yourself and your background, and give us a little bit of insight into who Union Rescue is.
I'm a New Orleans native. I worked in the fashion industry for 36 years. Traveled back and forth to New York like 333 times. It was a fun thing to do. My wife and I had a stillborn child in 1993, the day the Branch Davidian compound burned to the ground. So you're there and you're holding a lifeless son and thinking about what life could be like. You're watching these images on TV. And that was the day God tapped me on the shoulder and I just went on this journey, got engaged in several churches. My wife is in advertising and graphics. And together we helped energize a lot of organizations, a couple of churches, several nonprofits. And ultimately with the journey of why are we on the planet and what is it going to matter? But my life is older, over, have I accomplished much? So the fashion thing was a great gig for a long time and did a lot of fun things. But ultimately, at this stage of life, the journey kind of led me to the Union Rescue Mission. And as a board member, which I was there for 5 years as a board member, and they approached me 3 years ago to become an employee in the development of VP job. And my wife wouldn't let me take the gig at that point. And then the person they hired lasted about 15 months. And our CEO, Andy Bale, said, "Hey, how about now?" So we layered in the social enterprise thing to it to make it a little more significant job. We figured it out. The board supported me on that, encouraged me on that. And so I joined the team there as an employee back in last July, July 16th. You know, so like I said, I've been on this journey trying to figure out why we're on the planet. And I think Matthew 25 resonates with me. You know, whatever you did for the least of these, you did it to me. That's been a factor in who I've become over these last 26 years since that date back in 93. And I feel like I'm working for God now at URM.
That's awesome.
It's really been empowering, and every day's a new day. I'm working more hours, and I see my wife less, and she's like, "Wait a second, I didn't think that's what this is all about." But if you're helping impact humanity in a positive way, and this organization truly is, it's an honor to work there with the great colleagues I have. So,
tell us a little bit about that. What makes Union Rescue a significant organization?
Boy, there's a lot of that. They're the oldest in Los Angeles, 127 years. They are the largest privately funded homeless shelter in America.
In all of the U.S.?
In all of the U.S.
Wow.
In 2018, and I know this because I worked diligently with Andy, our CEO, and my wife who did the graphic design. I have a copy for you, our annual report, which was published this past week. And we're about to mail out about 7,500 to our most significant donors. We had 6,274 human beings come through the door that were homeless that came through our facility. Of that, 1,198 were children. We are bigger than the next five organizations combined on Skid Row.
Wow.
We average about 1,350 human beings under roof per night between our two locations. Down on Skid Row, we have a five-story building, 225,000 square feet. Then we have our Hope Gardens Family Center on 77 acres out in Sylmar. And we have a policy that we will never turn away a woman, a child, or a family, no matter what. And in 2018, at many times, you know, there's that 211 phone number. Mm-hmm. You know, you call that, I'm homeless, I have nowhere to go. And if the city is answering that phone number, they would send the families to us. And so we were close to maxing out in last fall, where we had as many as 272 children in our downtown facility. We have about 155 out in Sylmar with 75 moms and 25 senior ladies out there. But they quit answering the phone and they quit sending them our way lately. In fact, we had a walk to fight homelessness on May 11th. That was part of the way I got recruited onto the board. I helped create that event last year. So okay. In our first year as a board member, we had it at LA Live, raised $510,000, had 1,200 participants. Mm. Pretty good for a first year.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes. So we just had our second one, and we had Luke Robitaille out there with me on stage, and AC Green of the Lakers. He helped launch us into the walk, and it was a great day. And we were hoping for a bigger leap, but it's very restricted at LA Live on who you can get as sponsors to do that. But anyway, we got these three billboards. We got a screaming deal, $2,500 for three billboards in LA. Usually they're 10 to 20 grand per month. And so we did that, and they're still up. And so I turned to Andy, and we discussed it. I said, hey, you know, we have those billboards, and if we can get them for $2,500 for another month or however long, they'll probably leave them up. Unless somebody buys the space, they'll just stay there. And why don't we put experiencing homelessness, ? Call us. We never turn away a woman, child, or family. URM.org. So we have the graphics. I just got them revised this morning. And we've been debating the last 2 weeks. What phone number? How do we get an answer at least 6 a.m. to 11 p.m. or if not, 24 hours?
Yeah.
And Andy, who is the most Christ-like human being that I know personally, and that's part of why I took this job, we put a cell phone number on it.
About that, really?
That, I swear.
You know,
I swear.
That guy's for real. You don't know the story. But yeah.
He doesn't just talk the talk. He walks the walk. And, you know, he lost his leg to a flesh-eating disease.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
I love this guy. I love working with him. I tell him to take care of yourself. We got to do this. We got to rock it for the next 10. You know, God's calling us to it. Let's do the best we can.
Yeah.
But those billboards are going to be up in the next 10 days, 10 to 14 days.
That's amazing.
With his cell phone number on it. I'll show it to you at the end of this.
It's something that's really interesting to me. I think Andy is probably the most authentic ministry leader in rescue that I've experienced. I was talking with my friend Mark Horvath. So Invisible People, I don't know if you know Mark.
Yeah, absolutely. I follow him on Facebook, and he's Andy are
he's
close.
He's a big advocate of Andy's.
He says URM is the only true rescue mission that's open 24/7, 365, and never turns away anybody.
You're exactly right. So he said to me last week, he said, Andy Bales is the only rescue mission leader that will take a call at 3 a.m. and personally go bring someone back to the mission, which I think is, you know, given the work that we all do and the number of rescue missions in the U.S. and across Canada, even that says something. So I appreciate just how authentic you and your rescue is in your leadership in that area.
Yep.
L.A. is a really crowded market. You know, you say your wife's in advertising. I spent 14 years of my career at an Omnicom agency in Southern California. It's a crowded market. There's a whole lot of people. There's a whole lot of media properties. It's really expensive. Talk to me about how Union Rescue navigates that and maintains relevancy in the market when, you know, it's not just the nonprofit sector that you're competing with, but you're competing with all the commercial traffic and activity that happens in LA.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it's a really good question. And I've thought a lot about it and working on a lot of things in that realm because Los Angeles County and City just came out with the homeless count numbers today. They were supposed to come out Friday. They delayed them because they weren't good. So actually, I think we are in a position to really share our story. I talked to a PR firm about an hour and a half ago that did some pro bono work for us and said, hey, look, here's all the stuff we have going on. And it's a long list. I don't know how much time we have here, but still. homelessness is out of control, in Southern California. And we're waiting for the LA numbers. Here's the five counties around Los Angeles, all right? So Riverside's up 21% in a year. San Bernardino up 23%. Orange County up 43%. That's a 2-year jump. They didn't count in 2018. Kern County's up 50. 50? 50.
Wow.
Yep. It's not a big population there. It's small numbers, but it doubled. Well, it's up 50%, so it went up by 50. That's who we got. Ventura County's up 28%.
Okay.
LA just came out. The county is up 12%, and LA City is up 16%.
Wow.
So those are huge numbers, okay? And everybody's talking about it. I've got friends that heard it. Man, this is crazy. What the heck is going on? And I think a lot of people, they voted for H and HHH, and they go, oh, it's all solved. Okay, I'm fine. I don't need to donate. It's all fixed, right? And in the meantime, look what's going on. It's getting worse and worse and worse. And the city is doing some things, but it's just not enough. And I think actually we have a prosperity problem from some of the research I've looked at. People like, the economy's so good. Why not? Look, a lot of people have mental illness. A lot of people have drug and alcohol addiction. That's a big factor.
Yeah.
Probably half or more. But the affordability of the Los Angeles market is out of control. And there's a 40%, there's a 111% increase of children on Skid Row. Okay. Wow. You talk about how do we differentiate ourselves? Okay. That is 100% at Union Rescue Mission, that 100%, 111% increase, because nobody else on Skid Row takes children and families. Nobody. Most of them are mainly men. We are by far the biggest taker-enter of women and children and families, without a doubt. 40% of those experiencing homelessness in L.A. County are women and children. All right, so with those kind of stats, okay, and I already told you the numbers we took in, this is about 6,300 last year. How about we served 1.3 million meals last year, okay? We provided 470,000 nights of safe shelter in 2018.
Wow.
Okay. We got 933 people or more who entered our doors into a more permanent solution of housing. Show me another organization that did that in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And they did it with zero government funds. Not one dime. Nothing from the city, the county, the state, or the federal government.
Wow.
So I think that's a pretty good statement. It's a pretty good track record. We've been here for 127 years. And on June 30th, we'll be debt-free. We'll have zero debt, and we're raising $43 million to build a third location plus two other expansion projects, which I'll tell you about in a minute. Now's the time to tell you. I don't know. I don't want to tie you up too long, but we have a lot of good stuff. So we have three expansion projects. We're expanding Hope Gardens by 15 apartments for 15 moms with kids. That's 60 human beings. We've built a sprung structure, which is a fancy name for a giant tent that's 4,100 square feet, like a military tent. It's lasts about 25 years. It's up. We're just doing the wiring and the plumbing, and we have two trailers that have 11 bathrooms and showers. It'll be for single women that are on the streets of Skid Row that'll be able to stay in there, stay in their bunk all day, get three meals a day, and get enrolled in programs of things we're offering there.
Okay.
And then on top of that, we have this expansion where we bought this two-acre site that was a former laundry for a denim manufacturer. It's currently our warehouse. We're going to tear it down at the end of this year and build a 72,000 square foot 86 apartment, 370 bed facility for families, you know, dads with kids, moms with kids, and two parent families.
Okay.
Most of the families we have downtown are single moms, like 68 moms with kids and maybe seven dads. That's kind of a moving target. It's changing every day. But Hope Gardens, we can't have males over the age of 17. This facility, we're able to have males over 17 and have dads in that facility.
Okay.
So, I mean, who's doing that in L.A.? All with private money.
For sure.
So we already have about 1,500 under roof per night, that ability up to 1,550. And that's a lot of people on air mattresses on the first floor in our chapel and places like that. If we have that need, we never turn anyone away up to this point, and we'll never turn away a woman, child, or family. And then we're layering on between these three expansion projects, 550 beds, and all with private funds.
Now, I want to take us on a little tangent because I'm noticing something that you're the way that you're referring to the population that you serve. I've heard you say the phrase human beings maybe 15 times on this recording.
Sorry, I said it too much.
No. I mean, you know, we all work in this sector, and so often we hear folks who are experiencing homelessness referred to with many different terms, many of them not polite or pleasant. Is it intentional that you use that name, that word?
It is intentional, and Andy, our CEO, he drives it in our head. People are not the homeless. He cannot stand that statement, and none of us use it.
Yeah.
They are not the homeless. You know, they're like a thing, an entity.
Right.
They are people experiencing homelessness, you know, that they've fallen on hard times, they've lost their way in life. And we, as an organization, Nicole, it's, you know, it's like Christ said, whatever you did for the least of these, you did it to me. So we're stepping into that, and we're trying to do the best we can with that and live into those values and do it to the best of our ability. And we have a lot of amazing donors that walk hand in hand with us, that step up in amazing ways consistently to help us do this work.
That's awesome. So I want to talk a little bit about those donors, and particularly kind of connecting your donors and your support community with what's going on with the increase in homelessness in LA. And you just shared with us what the numbers are in the recent homeless count. And before we started recording, you were telling us a little bit about just that density in and around the Skid Row community. And you know, when if you turn on any news broadcast in Los Angeles these days, you're going to hear a story about homelessness.
Right.
The need seems exponential. Is that something that dissuades your donors? Are they experiencing fatigue? Do you hear donors saying, you know, we just don't know how you can ever, you know, move the needle here? Or are you experiencing something different? Are they coming alongside and really sort of doubling down on their support?
I think a little bit of both.
Okay.
There are some that they're in it no matter what. you know, because they see the distressing face of Christ in those individuals, and they have that calling and they have that compassion. So they're going to be there no matter what.
Okay.
I know Andy, he shared an email that he had from a guy that's been back and forth here today with him. The guy lives downtown. He owns a business or two. He walks a mile or two every day. And he says, you know, I've been giving to you guys, and you're a good organization, but these people are ungrateful, and I've watched them become the people living on the streets.
Yeah.
And there's no solution. You're not ever going to solve it. It's just going to be there. And they feel entitled. And if you give someone a dollar, that's not enough. I want more. You try to give them a meal. No, I want cash. And, you know, that's his personal experience. So, you know, I can't judge him on that. So there is some of that. But I think there is donor fatigue. I think some people are tired of hearing about it. I think some people think the government ought to step in and solve it. Say, why is it going to come out of my pocket?
Sure.
But there's others that are, especially if they come from a more faith perspective of what we're called to do while we're on the planet and we have resources, they want to provide some of that, you know.
So that's great.
Yeah.
Richard, I want to ask you a question here because you came out of the corporate sector, right? And wouldn't say I spent some time in the corporate sector before I got into fundraising as well. And I remembered my first day on the job, you know, and I thought in the environment I was in, and it was a rescue mission, but I was thinking, oh no, what have I gotten myself into? Because I could tell the culture was, you know, very different in a lot of ways. And I adapted, of course. But what was your experience? I mean, was it different or challenging coming from the corporate sector into a nonprofit context? And if so, if it was challenging in some ways, what are some of those ways?
There were some challenges, you know, but I came in with a humble mindset that, okay, yes, I was a board of director, you know, on the board of directors, and the board encouraged me to take this position. The CEO, Andy, and I had become friends and worked well together. So I had that connection. That was a real positive thing. So I actually wasn't, that helped a lot because I wasn't distracted with trying to build those relationships. They already existed.
Right.
And I had earned credibility by starting to Walk the Fight Homelessness, you know, June of last year. Had momentum. I collaborated with the staff. So I knew a lot of them, who the players were, you know, the marketing team and others there. So that was really empowering and made the transition a lot easier.
Yeah.
Like I said, I kind of said, look, I need to come in, and rather than, hey, I've observed these things and this is broken and that's not working and we're doing this. So I didn't do that. I came in from a very humble place, and I did one-on-one interviews with each of the players that were under my responsibility, whether they were management or, you know, a major donor officer or whoever, grant writer, et cetera, or an assistant. And I just met with them. The door's closed. What's between you and I stays here. You know, enlighten me. What is your work experience like? What are your frustrations? What are you excited about? If you are excited about anything, you know, what could be better, et cetera. And I took a lot of notes, and I did that for several weeks and you know, kind of let that sink in for the first month or two, and realized that there was a bit of a vacuum on the leadership of the people in the development department, and they needed some direction. In my realm, in the fashion industry, you came in on Monday. What happened last week? You know, what did our product do? What did our competitor's product do? What is trending? And the trend thing, because I've been in the fashion industry for over 30 years, I've been, and it's helped me working with churches and leadership for 25 years and that, of you see things and you're like, that's a trend. And that's not going well, and it's going to continue that way, where that's like a, you know, we would monitor that in the fashion industry, you know. That's not working. What's the next thing? What's going to carry the ball and make you be successful, whether it's in fundraising or spreading your story, telling your story, et cetera. So one of the things we did was there weren't reports. There was this, hey, here's your donors, and go do the best you can, was sort of the thing. And so one of the things I wanted to come in on Monday and know what each person in this department, how many touches they had with their donors, whether it was an email, phone call,
awesome,
receipt, donation, visit, tour, what did you do?
Yeah.
And what did you get in donations for that week? So we have these reports, and our team loves them. They love them, and we have a meeting. I meet with our development director, Tim, on Mondays, and then we all meet on Tuesday morning, and we kind of go through them. Hey, was it a good week? Was it a bad week? And what are we doing to make it better? So we created those things, and I didn't just come in from day one, but we implemented this stuff over the first 6 or 8 weeks. And it's to create some systems for accountability. And the person that was a development director left the organization for another one. I had taken over the meetings. I was running the meetings. And she would have one once a month. I have them every week. Let's stay engaged. Let's stay on focus.
Nice.
What's on our agenda? What do we have coming up? And we've implemented some things like donor appreciation lunches. And we're trying. They were mostly downtown. Now we try to go, you know, Los Angeles is 17 million people metropolitan, and we have people all over here. We have people out of state, you know, that are significant donors. But we try to go see them. We had one in Orange County last Friday for 26 people. We've been to Pasadena the month before. And we have, you know, at an upscale name restaurant like a Fleming's or a place like that.
Sure.
We've been to the Palm. We'll get a price break, and we'll take them to lunch. No alcohol, you know, so it's like $40.
Yeah.
And they show up, and we don't ask for money. Here's what's going on, you know, and I have a presentation I could show you guys later if you're interested, you know. Here's who we are and where we're going. And it kind of talks about some things we've talked about, the statistics of who we've served, what their donations are doing, and what the expansion projects we have underway to try and meet the need here in L.A.
That's awesome. Well, you know what I'm hearing you say, I think, Richard, a good takeaway I've already gotten from this, and I've been there at a Union Mission before, and I've been on Skid Row, and I've heard the stories about Andy and got to interact with him. Well, not directly, but he spoke at a function that was there. This was a couple years ago. And where I'm going with this is that I think you came into a situation where you had a really good foundation, and a lot of the different challenges that some that come into the nonprofit context have to face, just getting a level playing field and building the political and relational capital. And it sounds like a lot of that stuff, or most of it, was already taken care of. And seems like the vision there is just really clear. You guys seem to be a very mission, vision-driven organization. In other words, you exist for your cause and not just to exist for existing, you know?
Correct.
Yeah, so that's what I take away from that. Another question is, I mean, you're in L.A., and I've interacted some with the Mission down the street. What's the name of that one again?
L.A. Mission.
L.A. Mission. Yeah. I've talked to Herb and Ivan before, and they – you know, they've said, you know, the fundraising context and landscape here, they believe, is pretty different from other places. I don't know if they've lived in other places, but whatever. I mean, they have some good points. And I just want to get your perspective on that. You're in a diverse context, and so you're dealing with lots of different worldviews and perspectives. And like it or not, we all come with values. We all have values.
Yeah.
And you're dealing with a diversity of those, right? What do you do to navigate that? If you don't mind sharing with our listeners.
The diversity issue in general?
Yeah, particularly working with donors and knowing how to, can you adapt? What, you know, how do you handle these different viewpoints from your angle?
You know, we try to be welcoming to all people from all walks of life, whether they are, you know, a guest or they are employed there. 25% of our staff, we have about 183 employees. 25% to, and it's been as high as 30 at times, but it's approximately 25% of our staff are former guests. Very ethnically mixed. My senior leadership team has great diversity. There's seven of us. So, you know, it's a real priority for Andy to take that approach and welcome anyone and everyone that comes through our door. And in our outreach and to all that we deal with around the city, I mean, a good example is we have this, we're expanding with that, it's called Angela's House, by the way, that third location, the satellite in South LA. We hope to break ground on that end of this year, probably December, something like that, and hopefully have it completed by December 2020. That is in an inner city neighborhood. It's in South LA, 132nd and Avalon Boulevard. And why that location? Because 65% or more of the people on Skid Row come from there.
Yeah.
So why not go to where they are? You know, Andy's vision is to decentralize Skid Row. I mean, the city has pushed everybody together, and that's why you have this cluster of 49 city blocks that are Skid Row with over 1,000 or 1,100 registered sex offenders. I mean, that is a failed plan by our city leaders. So we are looking to diversify that. We already have Hope Gardens. We created that 12 years ago and moved out there. And in 12 years, there's been zero incidents of any problem. It's a very, very, very diverse community. We have established an alumni association of women from all walks of life. And so down in South LA, so we're looking to move down there to serve that community so they can stay near their church, family, school, friends, and not pull them down in the mean streets of Skid Row. I mean, especially we're focused, like I said, we'll never turn away a woman, child, or family. We see that 40% of those experiencing homelessness are women and children. I mean, so let's step into that void. Let's, because nobody else in Skid Row is accepting children or families. Yeah. And the number of women accepted down there is very few as well.
Yeah.
So we have reached out with a sort of a grassroots, very quiet campaign. Most people don't know we're doing this, and we're doing this, you know, and we reach out quietly for this shelter. And really, it's a bridge housing facility. It's not a homeless shelter. Knock on the door. Hey, let me in. I have nowhere to go. You need to either enter in through our downtown facility and then be moved over there, or come through an agency we have a relationship with, or some of these churches that I'm about to tell you about down in that neck of the woods that, hey, we have a homeless family that been, I have a family that's been evicted from there. Can you, do you have space for them? Those kind of things. And so we've reached out to, I started with the church right next door to this warehouse, which is going to be where our facility is located. It's the Greater Pearl Baptist Church right next door. And we called up, we had a, Kitty Davis Walker called him up. She's a colleague of mine. She's our VP of PR. Set up the appointment, and we went down there to see Pastor Thompson. And they nervously awaited our arrival. And like, oh my goodness, they've seen our vehicles come and go because it's our warehouse, right? Oh my goodness, they're going to export Skid Row. There's going to be tents outside the building. Huh. You know, everybody that's there. Oh my, you know, they panic. And we went down there, showed them who we are and where we're going, and they're like, wow. This is so exciting. You want to bring social enterprise here. You want to give people a place to land. Yeah, you want to have help people find jobs. We so need this. So from there, they invited three more pastors, and we went back and did the presentation again. Wow, this is great. We need it in our community. Then they set up a Saturday morning, 7 a.m. at a church with 13 to 15 pastors did the same thing. They said, what do you need? You need to help you raise funds. You know, what do you need from us? Says, you know what? We're doing pretty good on the fundraising thing. You know, I'm sure your churches need that. You keep keeping it where you're there. But when we go live to the community, and there will be people that will push back and won't welcome us, and they'll be upset that we're coming with this, stand in solidarity with us, and let's be united. You need this. You believe in this, and you welcome us into the community. That's what we need for you. So we're all in. And then we had one of the largest churches in that neck of the woods, Crenshaw Christian Center. Pastor Fred Price Jr., he and his wife came down. We had Christmas in July and December. They came with a couple other folks from their church. We showed the presentation to them, and they were blown away. And in fact, for our Walk to Fight Homelessness, they, you know, Fred's dad was the founding pastor, and they're a giant church. They had thousands and thousands of members, giant school. They're really thriving there. They're in Compton. They would have an annual mission fund that they would try to raise $1 million, and most of the funds would go out of the country. And he says, why are we sending it there? There's tents all up and down Vermont. Says, we should be focusing that on this problem here in L.A. So they have adopted us, the Union Rescue Mission, as their mission. They showed up for a Walk to Fight Homelessness, 233 participants, and raised over $21,000.
Wow.
And we're going to be their main focus with their mission fund going
forward.
That's
awesome.
So we're actually trying to start an advisory board and have Pastor Fred be a major player in that group. We're going to meet with him later this month to talk about that and see what that might look like. So you know, we've reached out to an inner city neighborhood, and we've been warmly received. We've got a great rapport with the folks in the community and the churches and the pastors. And, you know, we're transparent. We are just transparent. We just show who we are. We have nothing to hide. We're just trying to do what we're called, you know, to bring that role in that community that needs it so desperately.
Awesome. Right. And what about from a, like, as you interact with the stakeholders, the donors, and maybe it's not directly through the body of Christ, like maybe it's someone who's not a Christian, who, you know, or doesn't espouse the Judeo-Christian ethic, whatever, they've got a different viewpoint, but yet they're donating. Do you have any donors like that, that maybe they're not Christians, or they have some different viewpoints and values, but yet they still align with your cause, or no?
For the most part, you know, people ask, gee, or, you know, if somebody's Jewish, will they give to your cause? We have a lot of amazing Jewish donors who are people of high net worth that realize the role we play in the community and the difference we're making and the fact that we're faith-based. I mean, that's part of the reason we're getting nothing from the city. Or, you know, the city, state, or county government. We're getting nothing. We're faith-based.
Right.
You know, if you take money from them, it's like, okay, well, you have to allow people to continue to use drugs and alcohol. Well, that's not going to work in our facility. You're not going to transform their lives.
Right.
They're not going to come in high. They're going to come in loud. And some come in from the streets that are at our place. We're like, sorry.
Sure.
You know, yeah. And we'll be patient with them. We'll try and put them in a place. Hey, look, you know, work it out. You know, sit over here. You can't go up to the third floor where you have a room up there because you're drunk.
Right.
That kind of a thing. And if after about three times you go, hey, there's a pattern here, I'm going to ask you, have to ask you to leave.
Yeah.
There's a term for it, Andy talk. I'm trying to think what it's called. But you have to allow them to continue to do that. And so there's places around town, but that's still going on. I don't think they're getting the life transformation.
Yeah, I would agree.
Because of that, you know. Same with the trans thing. Currently with HUD, if a male sees themselves as a female and you're taking money from HUD, you have to allow them to shower and sleep where the women sleep. Well, that's an awkward situation.
Right.
So, you know, we're really sensitive to it, and we welcome the trans community, and we have many there, you know, that, but we have a special accommodation.
Yeah.
It's kind of as a, you know, in-between place that, hey, here's where you can be.
Right.
But if you've had the life change operation, great, you're welcome to go over there.
Yeah.
But if you haven't, you have to be where your anatomy currently says you are.
Yeah.
So we're really sensitive to that. We work with them. We've actually gotten really high marks from folks in the trans community that have been sensitive and loving and welcoming.
That's awesome.
I think their biggest challenge is they could be abused verbally and mentally and other ways by guests that are there that are threatened by them or, you know, or prejudiced against them. But our staff has done a great job, and Andy has preached that to let's be that.
Yeah, well, that answers my question. You're meeting people where they are. And
exactly,
and that's translates not relegated to just the people that you're working with, the human beings, but throughout the donor base as well. It seems like that's being transferred over, and that's an easy sell. I mean, if you've got those high marks, like in the trans community, that answers my questions about how do you navigate the diversity there within the donor base, right? Sells it. I mean, you can sell that. You know, it's there. So, last question I have: you mentioned social enterprise, and first of all, I guess let's maybe unpack real quick what is social enterprise, because maybe some of our listeners don't know that term. And once you unpack it, Richard, if you could connect it, describe any connection to philanthropy, you know, because I know there's a whole world out there like Christian Community Development Association and Chalmers Center and the Grameen Bank and the guy who started that and this whole movement, you know, that I think has brought a lot of value to the, you know, or the rescue mission space. You know, books like When Helping Hurts, Toxic Charity by Lupton, all this stuff is birthed out of this. So why don't you explain what social enterprise is and what's the connection to philanthropy?
Social enterprise, and part of the reason I was giving that was, you know, I came from a fashion background and I helped the thrift store, which was going to be shut down by the board of directors because it was unprofitable the first 2 years. And then I got the fashion industry to contribute to it and give new garments that were slightly flawed, and it's now 40% of the sales of the thrift store. So it's turned into a successful enterprise.
Yeah.
And then I had vision. There's a place, I'm a New Orleans native, and there's a place there called Cafe Reconcile that Emeril Lagasse, this chef, you know, he's on the board of directors. Shell Oil is a big contributor and some other corporations. And it's for inner city youth, 16 to 24, and they teach them to be employees in restaurants.
Yeah.
And it's been very successful. I think they've got like 2,500 inner city youth that have been found jobs in New Orleans, such as a thriving restaurant business. And I brought that to Andy as a board member several years ago. And like, hey, maybe we could do that too. You know, and he still likes that idea. I've registered the name Cafe Redemption and Cafe Reconcile. No, I've registered the name Cafe Redemption and URM Cafe to maybe do a Homeboy Industries type thing. And I'll answer your question and we'll be back to philanthropy. But anyway, it's we would like to create, you can give someone a fish or you can teach them a fish. And for the most part, we have been giving people the fish. Come on in, put a roof over your head, give you a safe place to land, feed you. We partner with Pepperdine Mental Health, Pepperdine Legal Aid, UCLA Medical, and USC Dental. So they come in, we do all of that stuff. But it's like giving them a fish, okay? We came in, we solved their problems. We try to give them some financial management skills so they don't, recircle back into that because they made poor decisions. And also have recovery programs for all of those kind of things. But people need that economic engine to have a long-lasting effect when they leave our place and not cycle back into it.
Right.
So what we're trying to do is create social enterprise opportunities where they can be employed, save some money, have work experience, have a work record. because a lot of them have, you know, criminal records and all that kind of stuff. So I came in thinking, focused on expanding the thrift store. We have a thrift store that is now making about $75,000 a month in sales, where its break-even point is about $52,000. So it's making $20,000 to $25,000 a month. It employs 15 people. The problem with this location, it's in Covina, so it's 25 miles from downtown's facility, and it's 42 miles from Hope Gardens. So geographically, it's not a great location to provide jobs for our guests.
Yeah.
We try to do it. We have a truck driver and another person at Covina that have come from downtown that have worked out. But so what we're trying to do is expand out at Hope Gardens, because those moms are there 2 to 3 years. So they go through the program. They become an apprentice after a year. Then, okay, they're there for another year or two. Let's put them in the situation. We're working in a thrift store. Minimum wage on July 1st is $14 an hour. They could save $12,000 to $20,000 over the next year to 2 years, get out, buy a used car, have money for a deposit, you know, move into an apartment. You've got your life stabilized. That's what we're trying to do.
Yeah.
We have an idea for a restaurant idea. Porto's Bakery gives us $1.6 million in in-kind gifts per year. Starbucks bought us 2 refrigerated vans. We have the keys to 80 Starbucks stores, and we go in and lock the back door at night. And we've got $1.9 million in product. Everything in a refrigerated case that has an expiration date of today for these 80 Starbucks stores around Los Angeles will be in our facilities for our guests and people living on the street.
Isn't that awesome?
Tomorrow.
That's really cool.
So what if we open?
Good for them, but they're partnering.
Yeah, URM Cafe, and it's right next door to URM Thrift and Boutique.
Right.
And we're employing, you know, 8 to 15 people at each enterprise. You know, spreading the word, and it's a partnership on the, you know, we have the fashion industry that's helping feed the boutique part of the thrift store, which is a different model than everybody else in thrift. We have a giant banner outside there, new clothing from the factory, direct from the factory, $2.99 to $7.99. That's helped drive that business.
Sure.
We're creating a whole new model. There's tons of fashion industry companies based in Los Angeles. So we hope to grow that relationship. And then what if Starbucks, who has a heart for this, I told you what they've done at Porto's, has a huge heart. They just had a commercial that Bank of America created for Betty Porto, showing her heart and how she's interacted with our children and what she's done for us. So what if we did that? You know, URM Cafe, a joint venture of Porto's, Starbucks, and the Union Rescue Mission.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that'll happen, if it's reality, but it's an idea. And I think we'll have something of that nature. We'll still want to partner with us. But again, it's teaching them to fish, build up that savings account. We're big on savings account. We have people that become apprentices in our place. We have hundreds that become apprentices. That's part of our program, that life transformation. You save 80% of that money. You use the balance for your cell phone or whatever. And then when you leave, you have X amount of saved up. Here's an example of that. One of the drivers, we've been doing this now about 2 years, 18 months to 2 years. One of the drivers of the Starbucks vans for this route came through our program. And if a check is over a certain amount, you have to have 2 signatures. And it's either the Andy, our CEO, Dan, our CFO, or myself.
Okay.
So the CFO said, hey, I need you to co-sign this check. And it was $20,000. I'm like, well, who's this? Turns out it was one of the drivers of the van for the Starbucks thing. It saves $20,000. Again, a graduate from our program. And he was taking the money to go open up his own savings account and move it into a regular bank. And
that's awesome.
And start to look to move out of the facility and get on with
that's
life.
So cool.
Yeah. I mean, that's the kind of thing we're talking about. That's life transformation. That is social enterprise at work. And that is teaching people to fish, just not giving them a fish.
So you're saying it's part of the program. And so essentially bringing work ethic, getting people, the disenfranchised, to become franchised, right?
Right.
Equipping them in that way. You can sell that to donors, it sounds like.
Yes,
they
yes.
want to fund that because they know that these are going to produce lasting outcomes. Am I
exactly correct? Exactly. And that's the thing on writing for grants and reaching out to donors. They want to know that we're making a difference. And the more long-term outcomes we can show through the increase in the growth of these social enterprises, I believe the more they'll be engaged.
Yeah.
And for example, we're ready to launch the next thrift store, and we've come up with the formula. Dan and I and Andy have discussed it. Dan's our CFO. And thrift store or multiple thrift stores for $150,000. So we're looking in and around the Sylmar area where Hope Gardens is, because the moms are there on average 2 to 3 years. Versus downtown, it's more transitional. Some
sure.
people are there 3 months, 6 months, 9 months.
Yeah.
Some are longer, but they're there at a very safe place. Their kids are going to school. We have tutoring. It's a great environment. You get these moms engaged in that. So we're hoping we can grow that and expand that. I kind of lost my train of thought where I was going to go with that whole thing. But social enterprise, I want to give you another thing that that we're doing. So PPG Industries has a giant plant, 450 employees in Selma. Oh, I'm sorry. The thrift store. We're looking for three locations in and around Hope Gardens. We're looking Santa Clarita, Granada Hills, Pacoima, where you're a 15-minute drive from Hope Gardens. So those we'll have a store manager who's been trained at the other location. And they'll be moved, and we'll just settle them back and forth to the thrift store. So that's where we're trying to build that, where it's geographically close, and we can grow that around there. But so as far as philanthropy goes and donors doing that, we've reached out and written grants to multiple banks and entities that are interested in job creation.
Yeah.
We got $25,000 from Wells Fargo. We got $25,000 from Bank of the West. We are matching that with $50,000 from profit from the existing store. We're looking for another $50,000 from a philanthropic source. Could be an individual, could be another bank or a foundation or whatever.
Oh, right.
And so when we get that 150, I have a retired donor, great guy, who is running around looking for, he's a retired executive from the commercial real estate industry, who has searched 16 locations, said none of them are good enough, and he's looking for the next one. So when we get the next 50,000, we're ready to launch that. We hope to do that.
That's really cool.
And, you know, the next 3 or 4 months, hopefully. But one other thing on social enterprise. So PPG Industries, talk about corporations with a philanthropic heart. They are a giant corporation, 47,000 employees worldwide. They paint every airplane on the planet Earth other than Russia. They make windows for almost every jet and fighter plane on the planet Earth other than Russia. They have a aerospace industry facility near Hope Gardens out in Sylmar. They came and they handed out candy for a harvest festival October before last. Last October, they came in with 172 volunteers.
Wow.
And painted the bottom half of the exterior of the buildings. Then they came back and painted a mural. Now they're starting a employment program that started 3 weeks ago.
Wow.
They have brought 15 moms. All of them have a criminal record. Two have felonies, which might limit what they can do because they're working in a facility making windows for fighter jets for the government. but 13 have other, not the best backgrounds, but they've been training them in interview skills, training them in resume writing. That was the last 2 weeks. This week, they're going through practice interviews with the real people who are decision makers at PPG.
Cool.
And so they have adopted us. They are thrilled at what they're doing, and they're planning to hire between 2 and 5 women into this plant that they're looking to expand. And they're so thrilled about what we're doing, they've approached us. They need land to expand their plant because they just got a big contract for the new F-35 fighter jet, and they need a bigger facility. And they've asked us, could we buy 20 acres of your 77 acres at Hope Gardens, level some of these hills, and build a 500,000-square-foot facility, and then have a program where we hire your graduates in, you know, 3 to 5 per year.
Wow, awesome.
And we're so interested in what you're doing.
That's
we will build affordable housing for your employees who are only make minimum wage.
Huh.
So
anyway. That's a fun, you know, I got to have a taste of that because I started a recovery organization that was a social enterprise, self-sustaining. And so I've seen how rewarding that interplay is. And you get into some really cool, that's some fun fundraising, man.
Yeah.
I mean, that is some cool stuff that you're talking about. It doesn't get any better than that. I think on a future show, Andrew, we should probably try to unpack, and maybe it's with Richard, this concept of social entrepreneurship, you know, right? Because there's interplay between, that's different than the social enterprise is what they're starting, but that'd be something, you know, like another show, I think.
For sure. Richard, we are out of time. This has been a great conversation. I appreciate you sharing with us.
Yeah, certainly.
The one last thing I'd like to do is, you know, often we have folks listening who they'll hear something and it'll spark an idea and they want to follow up. If someone wants to get in touch with you, what's the best way for somebody to do that?
Send me an email. So rnewcomb, N-E-W-C-O-M-B, @urm.org.
Awesome. Thank you again for your time today.
Thanks, Andrew.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Rainmaker Fundraising Podcast, brought to you exclusively by Newport One. Newport One can make a difference in your fundraising so that you can change the world. You can always reach us at podcast@newportone.com. Please take a moment to rate this episode on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. When you rate this episode, it will help more nonprofit leaders just like you to help find us and get the information that they need to raise more funds for their organization. Thanks again for listening today.